Malcolm Honlein is Executive Vice Chairman of the Conference of Presidents of Major American Jewish Organizations, joins us for the weekly update here on a Friday morning broadcast. Mr. Honlein, welcome back to JM and the AM.
Thank you. It's good to be back with you.
Are you looking back at 2012 with the fond memories already, or are you going to wait for the year to end?
I can't even remember it anymore.
Boy, when you think of the volume of stuff that's happened.
It's certainly on overload. This was a decisive year, and more than that, it leaves decisions ahead that are going to be of immense consequence. If you think of what happened in Egypt, what happened in what's happening in Jordan, what's happened just in the Middle East context,
yeah.
In Tunisia, what's happening today in Syria, what's happening in Iran, what's happening in the Gulf, just now, things that are going to carry into the new year when decisions will have to be made and when a lot of the seeds that were sown are going to start come to bloom, it's going to be really a very demanding year.
I wonder if 12 months ago, if I described for you what the relationship would be in December 2012 between the President of the United States and the Prime Minister of Israel, for instance, and in general, U.S.-Israel relations, and how the United States is dealing with major difficulties like Iran's and nuclear potential, etc. I wonder if you would have taken this, so to speak, if you would have signed up for this, if you would have been satisfied that we would have gotten to this stage 12 months later.
I can't say that I would be satisfied with where we are on any of the fronts right now. Again, part because we didn't reach conclusions. We saw exacerbation of problems, but certainly one can't say that Egypt is closer to a solution or that we know which direction. We see the direction it's going in, but certainly we could not have predicted, nor would we have wanted to see this outcome, or what's happening within the PA and the Hamas post the war. And I mean, just so many fronts, the United Nations, the UN, the UDI move, the growth of the boycott and divestment and sanctions movements, you know, isolated cases on campuses across the country, just in the University of Toronto this week, graduate students voted to join it. I think that, these are very serious issues. I know people don't like to hear about it. They want us only to tell them the good news, which we try to do also. And we see that in that we finished the year with still more than half the American people, as in keeping with most of the pattern, supporting Israel, that the support in Congress remains very strong, administration. So, there are good things as well, but really serious challenges.
Many challenges ahead. When Brian Schatz is now U.S. Senator from Hawaii in place of a Senator Inouye, so it brings back the number to 11 Jewish senators. I don't know if you know this offhand. I'm just curious. Has that number ever been larger? Has there ever been more than 11?
Yes.
There were once
up to 12 or 13.
Wow.
Everyone, Arlen Specter and many others were there. But whatever, it's still a remarkable number.
Yeah.
1-2% of the population produces 10 or 11% of the Senate.
Just incredible. Why was there a secret meeting this week between Prime Minister Netanyahu, and we will speak about the election campaign in minutes, between Prime Minister Netanyahu and King Abdullah of Jordan?
It's a secret. That's why it's a secret meeting. I think it dealt with a number of things. One was for the Prime Minister to show support for the King of Jordan, who is beleaguered right now and under a tremendous amount of pressure. I think it was also related to the situation in Syria, and particularly about the chemical weapons in Syria, which is something Jordan, like Israel, has been very concerned about, the fear that some of this has been smuggled into Jordan by the tens and hundreds of thousands of Syrians who have come there as refugees. And in fact, many thousands now are leaving back to Syria to fight, those who came to Jordan in particular, even more than Turkey or Lebanon, where the fighting has been ongoing on both of those borders. But here in Jordan, just in the last weeks, we've seen that thousands are going back. I guess they're smelling blood and thinking that the regime is going to fall. So Bibi went there, I think, to reaffirm the commitment to the king, to talk about some joint efforts. And I think Israel gives reassurances to Jordan that if something happens, they'll be there.
And was that the secrecy of it? Because not always is it the best idea if you want to, show broad support to bring the Prime Minister of Israel in to, it wouldn't exactly enhance your reputation among the Arab nations?
Well, certainly, and in Jordan itself, we have to remember that the
right.
peace has been the peace with the king and not with the people, that the polls show you know, 90% opposition, that people, professionals who go and work in Israel or visit Israel, get thrown out of professional associations, and the king is criticized for being too soft on Israel, especially when you have the Muslim Brotherhood growing and Iran messing around there and others. And you saw it reflected also, Jordan very harshly lashed out at Turkey over their role in supporting some of the Islamist groups fighting to overthrow the regime of Bashar Assad, because I think they said that Syria could devolve into a black hole that sucks jihadists from around the Arab world. And of course Jordan becomes a staging ground, and that the more advanced weaponry that these guys are getting through Turkey could destabilize Jordan as well.
All right, to the Israeli political scene, does Tzipi Livni want to be foreign minister of Israel?
I think that's a lot of speculation. That I don't think there's any reality to it. I think that Netanyahu would not look to Livni particularly. I do think Yair Lapid could be in there. I think Yachimovich and Labor could more likely be there. The latest polls show them, one poll that showed them at 39, now I see that it's 33, yeah. Which is typical of polls, you know, in Israeli elections.
Yeah, but that is a big jump, a big drop.
It is a big drop, but again, they have different methodologies, and right. They have, you know, different pollsters come up with different results. But that is, as you said, very significant. The Bayit Yehudi, led by Bennett, getting, by some estimates, as many as 15 seats now. Labor would get 16. And that doesn't leave much for Yair Lapid and Kadima to do. But the shifting within the different segments of the populace, I think, is an ongoing process that we will still see continue. The one thing everybody acknowledges is that Bibi will be the prime minister unless there is some even more sudden shift that is not predictable at this point. You have Shas now going after Likud. For a while they went after Bayit Yehudi, mm-hmm. who and Bennett, the leader there, hurt himself badly with some comments he made about the insubordination, or appeared to be making, yeah. And he backtracked on it.
The way the media portrayed it, yeah.
And, you know, they exploited it rather than just simply an answer that he gave about his feelings. It wasn't smart, and he recognized it.
But why have the Shas attacks gone from him to Likud?
Because now they're trying to paint the Likud as being representing whites and Russians, whites meaning Ashkenazim, right. And Russians, and not Sephardim, because they're drawing Sephardic votes as well away from Shas. Shas itself is not doing well in the polling, and they're divided, of course, you know, between Derry and Yishai, and though they put on the front of unity. And Lieberman draws votes from Shas voters when they look around for alternatives, and so does Abayda Yehudi. So they're now lashing out, but I think we're going to see this intensify as we get closer to the election. There's a tendency in Israel for them to escalate the language that is used. You see the attacks on Bibi constantly regarding the results of the war, both from left and right. We see the attacks. And, of course, Iran will remain a major issue in the election. And the domestic situation, which we don't get into much here in the United States, people don't follow the economic and other realities. Bibi has to cut almost a billion shekels. He has to, in the budget. That's one of the reasons for the election, is to get the support to do what he has to do. But he also faces some social unrest, and there are real concerns within the countries. So the Bibi runs on security, he runs on, you know, being tough and showing that he, at the same time, can reach out to Jordan and still can play a role with outside.
Often we see meddling from outside of Israel in the Israeli election. We've actually seen it from the United States. I don't know if you would have portrayed it then as meddling, but you know what I mean. Under the last couple of presidents we've seen, last few presidents we've seen, at times, them take an interest on separate occasions in who might be the next prime minister. Because it's a foregone conclusion, is that why we've really heard nothing outside of Israel about this election?
No, first of all, because there have been so many other distractions And I think, you know, we still have until the 22nd, so that's more than 3 weeks. I think you will see much more attention focused as we get closer. Americans tend to find Israeli elections curious and of interest, and Netanyahu is somebody who's so well known. They don't know any of the other oppositions. You don't have a Peres, you don't have a Rabin, you don't have somebody else.
But you could see the President of the United States over the next 3 weeks doing something either blatant or you know, not such a blatant fashion that would...
I don't think, first of all, I don't think he would do it. I think they still resent what they consider Bibi's intervention or apparent support for Romney, which Bibi, of course, denies. But still many in the Democratic Party and the administration still raise this at meetings or make references.
All the more so to get involved.
So, no. So he first of all, the president's got plenty on his plate. What Tillich sees if he goes over the cliff or not.
We go over the cliff.
Many other issues. He's going to be more careful about not getting involved, and also because it wouldn't influence the election that much. The voters for Bibi are not going to be swayed if the president, you know, comes out against him. Actually, people tend to rally around the candidate if they feel he's being assaulted from the outside.
Yes.
So if they really wanted to influence the outcome, then they're doing it the right way by staying out of it. But I think that they're going to be very careful about it.
Is the Hagel nomination finished with or not?
No, it is not finished with. It may be today. It may be a little longer. But the fact is that the announcement was going to be made last week. It was not. It was supposed to be made this past week. And as you know, Kerry was announced last Friday. And we already had discussed it before.
Right.
It was no longer a surprise. And I had the opportunity to spend an hour with him right before the announcement was made.
So does he get it or not?
Oh, he gets it. Listen, the guy was chairman of foreign relations, been a senator for decades. He's been involved. He considers himself a friend to Bibi, and Bibi issued a statement saying that he's known him for many years and considers him a friend. So he knows. He knows what's going on. His positions aren't exactly the same, and on some issues he's a little bit to the left of the president. On other issues he may be to the right. But I would say he's close to where Biden was. I think he's somebody who's put a lot of time into the Middle East, so it's an area of interest to him. But on his voting record on Israel was very good.
America's one and only Jewish Moments in the Morning radio program, heard and listener-sponsored WFMU East Orange, WMFU Mount Hope, around the world on the web, jmnam.org. Fridays, we call this the weekly update. I have the pleasure of speaking to Malcolm Honlein and getting his take on what's happening in this amazing world of ours. Is there going to be a civil war between Hamas and Fatah, especially in lieu of who controls the areas of Judea and Samaria that the PA has?
I don't think we could say it's going to be a civil war. We see the rise of Hamas influence, and especially after Operation Pillar of Defense, where the perception was created that Hamas was victorious, and you saw that the vast majority now, even of West Bank residents, say armed resistance is the only way. The polls show that Haniyeh would beat Abbas, the leader of Hamas, would beat the leader of Fatah. Fatah called off its commemorative demonstrations in Gaza for the anniversary of its creation, which will take place in the West Bank. But Hamas, for the first time, held major demonstrations. They talk about reconciliation. Hamas, in fact, Hamas leaders said this week that reconciliation would be based on rejection of Israel's right to exist. We're seeing more and more protests by Palestinians, which I discussed before, and said that we would likely see an increase in what they call a popular intifada, meaning that people take up not suicide bombing and not rifles, but take up rocks and tried to draw international attention.
The old-fashioned intifada.
And they are hitting many cars. It's becoming dangerous in some areas where people drive and are bombarded by rocks that not only damage cars but have killed people in the past. We're seeing demonstrations against UNRWA because they closed some offices and fired 114 of the staff people, which shows how many people they actually have working. There was a terrorist cell of the PFLP that this week was caught. They were trying to kidnap soldiers, the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine, that is. And we're seeing more and more incitement where you have calls for the Intifada and calls that Al-Aqsa is in danger, meaning the Harabayit, and that the Jews are undermining it, even though this is, they all know it's not true, but it's the rallying call that we've seen them resort to because it gets an automatic response each time. And Abbas is now threatening to go to the International Criminal Court. They're threatening that if Bibi is reelected, then that will launch all sorts of retaliatory steps. They're doing nothing in terms of coming to the table. So I think that the situation there is right now has gotten increasingly worse. And we see in Gaza that Israel sends in more trucks, gave them certain benefits as a part of the ceasefire arrangement, where more construction equipment is going in, I think 20 trucks a day now, and they've opened up the embargo somewhat to provide for general construction, not just that of international parties, which is more, controllable.
Well, the situation here in the United States in regard to President Obama and the attitude toward Iran has never really been discussed since his reelection. Now that he has been reelected, and we see this push by the United States Senate this week on Washington about the Iranian military option. And I don't want to ask, I don't want to do the old, shouldn't we just bomb Iran and all that already? I'm just trying to get a perspective from you now that the American election is over and he's in a second term, where this puts him on the scale of the possibility of the U.S. intervening in a military fashion. Do you think it's more likely, less likely? Now with the Senate still putting this type of pressure on the president, how will that affect it? Is it much different than when the president was in his first term?
Well, it will be different because, frankly, we're coming to the deadline. This is not something that is a red line painted on a pseudo bomb in at the UN that Bibi held up. We're talking about the real deadline coming, right, and coming soon. It'll be a time when decisions have to be made by the U.S. within the year, by Israel within the next 6 months, less. It doesn't mean they have to take the action, but the decisions have to be made. I think both sides are ready. Everybody's preference is that it be a multi-party effort. There will be more sanctions. The Congress is pushing more sanctions. The Europeans are supposed to enact some more sanctions. There are some that are coming into effect in February. I spoke just yesterday with people from the resistance in Iran, and they're looking to the critical election that will take place there for president in June, when Ahmadinejad will be out. He's running a candidate, but there's a fight within the Khamenei supporters about who will run, and of course that person will win.
Right.
But that is exacerbating tensions in the country. We see various people being put forward. The fight between Ahmadinejad and Khamenei continues. The actions inside Iran are going to force a hand too, because they are expanding the construction of Parchin. Now they're saying, well, if Israel's threats are stopped and everything else, we'll let inspection there, because they cleanse the place. They build buildings over where they carried out the experiments in weaponization, and they think that they can obscure it, but they forget that the satellites are catching all of this. At the same time, they started now new naval exercises in the Straits of Hormuz. They're doing more and more chutzpahdik stuff, the base that I talked about in Sudan and base at Abu Musa in near the Straits. We see the Gulf Cooperation Council, meaning the UAE and five other countries, Bahrain, Saudi Arabia, others, creating a unified military command against Iran, and they say specifically against Iran. I talk about Iran's increasing interference, saying that they are, rather than the image that Iran is pulling back, and though its economy is in ruins, the unemployment, some people say, is as high as 70%. As long as they get the money from the oil that they can sell, a billion barrels a day, if they get $30 billion a year, they can continue to function. They don't care about what the condition is, and it makes the condition internally more right for action against the regime, not from the outside, but from the inside. And the election coming up in June could present an opportunity when we look to the year ahead. And inflation is running anywhere from 30, 40, 50%, people say. I think the estimates of 70% unemployment are very high, but I think that the numbers, real numbers, could be 30-40%, maybe more, and people are not getting paid for 6 months, 8 months. The sale of gold, which was ongoing in Turkey, playing a role to bypass it. Now we have new sanctions that will address that. And Iran is involved, continuing to be involved in Syria, providing weapons, not relenting on the support, and of course for Hezbollah, which is under siege, and we'll talk about that in a minute, but that's more related to Syria than
right.
it is to the tensions.
So you don't think that a second term Obama is any more or less likely to take military action against Iran than the first term Obama? Not much of a difference, you would say.
I think it's the reality on the ground that's going to drive
right,
it.
Right, that will determine
it. And there comes a point where you can no longer avoid it. What really is critical is that the president has to convince the Iranians that we are prepared to use force. Until now, I think they are not prepared.
Right.
They don't believe or are not convinced that we're really ready to use force. And we see the efforts to reach out, that there's still attempts by the administration to have direct negotiations, and the P5 plus one are due to have negotiations, and there are true reports and false reports about the extent of the effort to reach out. But it also could be an effort by the president to say, look, I tried everything.
Right.
We even talked to them, and still nothing came about. We know that they're moving ahead all the time. And all the statements being made by Khamenei do not indicate in any respect that they are that he is serious about changing, making a move at this point. In fact, we see quite the opposite of their meddling, even in the PA, Mashal, and with others, that the Iranians don't withdraw, that they become more adamant, more extreme, and talks are not going to yield any result from what we can see now.
Is there an easy answer to the question about whether Russia still at this point supports Assad or not?
Russia supports him, continues to play a role, but is diminishing it, and has come out for the first time talking about somebody else taking him, that they would not give him safe harbor, but that somebody else should. The Russian foreign minister has come out with some really remarkable statements this week, which I think indicate that they are recognizing the reality on the ground that Assad is likely to fall at some point. They have provided them with military equipment, and in fact, eight plane loads of Syrian banknotes were sent and printed in Russia and sent to Syria because they can't print them themselves anymore. But they are trying to negotiate a resolution. They don't want to see an overthrow. They want to see something that doesn't leave the Muslim Brotherhood in command, they say. We saw more Scuds being used. We've seen cluster bombs being used. That the toll is great. And the real danger about chemical weapons, there are reports that they were used 18 times, the rebels say. Others say that it isn't true. The Russians claim that the sites are still under complete control. Yet we see al-Nusra, the al-Qaeda in Iraq offshoot, continues. It is fighting Assad, but they continue to grow in influence. Brahimi, the negotiator, the international negotiator, was completely unsuccessful. He called now for a transitional government. And Assad today, they recognize controls less than a quarter of the country, and even parts of Damascus and Aleppo that he doesn't control. And the rebels are becoming more proficient. They're getting better and better weapons that they're taking from the Syrian army. And the Syrian army probably is getting very, very tired. So the Russians are sending very strong signals about how they read the reality on the ground. And when you have the chief of the military police and top generals and others defecting, that also tells you that that these guys also are recognizing.
Where'd they defect to?
Pardon me?
Where'd they defect to?
To the opposition. They went to the rebel forces. They go into Turkey when they leave the country. Go and right away sign up, because it also is an insurance policy for them to show that they really have recognized the reality. But and Israel is building a new fence along the border. 90 kilometers of the, along the armistice line, because this is in addition to the fence that everybody has seen was going up to the north, because they're anticipating also the fall and what the implications could be.
International community reaction to that fence?
and no reaction, because it's something that they're certainly allowed to do, and it doesn't impinge on anybody or in any place else. Where the international community is not paying attention, and which they better, is what's happening in Lebanon, where the war is really extending there between the Sunni villages along the Syrian border in the north, where you have constant firing across the border and fighting within. You have the Shiites in the Baqa, the same thing, fighting for Assad and with Hezbollah backing, and the Syrian forces fighting the Free Syrian Army. The Hezbollah drones flying more and more, by the way, along the Israeli border too, and Israel has expressed a lot of concern about these drones. First of all, they can be armed. Second of all, they monitor Israeli force movements. But the big issue, of course, remains the huge number of chemical and biological weapons, sarin gas, nerve gas. They claim that others are the other kinds of gas, and the mobile trucks that I talked about last week.
I read somewhere this week that Israel felt those were over-exaggerated.
No, the feeling is only about the degree to which they may have been used.
Oh, whether it'll be used is over-exaggerated.
No, have been used.
Oh, have been used already.
Right. And the feeling on a lot of people's part is that this is part of Assad preparing for his retreat, that he has a few options. One is to leave the country, but the generals won't let him. Two is to retreat to one of the Alawite areas. I mean, third is to fight to the last man. But the likelihood is that they will create some sort of a zone in one of the Alawite areas. We see a lot of Alawites moving to Tartus and to other places, and he could take these chemical weapons with him as a bargaining chip, protection, something. But frankly, that's not what's going to happen. Their real fear, of course, is that there will be retaliation and massacres, and that's also a concern of some in the international community, because it's likely to be a reality.
Tell me if I understand the situation in Egypt this week correctly. So the Morsi-constructed constitution actually went to a vote for approval, and this was a national vote? And what were the results, by the way?
Two-thirds for the constitution, the new constitution.
It was a national vote.
There was a vote. The question is how many people stayed home. The Muslim Brotherhood is clearly less and less popular. The problem is that the opposition is so divided against itself and in its opposition to Morsi that it fizzled after the first few days. In the beginning, there was very strong opposition. There are still big demonstrations.
I thought there were some arrests for treason among members of the opposition. That doesn't sound like a watered-down opposition. It sounds pretty serious.
No, this is typical. This is not unusual in Egypt. But what you really saw as a result of this election is it's not the imposition of Sharia law, but the creation of the circumstances for Sharia law to be imposed. And if there are things in there on blasphemy and other things which really set the stage for it. But the shift of power is to the upper house of the parliament, which is dominated by the Islamists, both the Salafis and the Muslim Brotherhood. And he is going to move more and more to consolidate his power. He won this, and he's going to call for parliamentary elections, I think, in the next few months. If you notice, he delayed the request for $4.8 billion loan that he's supposed to get from the International Monetary Fund because he's not willing to raise taxes and meet the requirements that they set, minimal requirements, for getting a loan, which he desperately needs because the economy is in really terrible circumstance there. Foreign reserves have shrunk by more than 50% from just a few months ago. Was it $30 billion? I think now it's $15 billion. So the economic situation has deteriorated and continues to do so, and that will lead to more and more unrest, and depends on who takes advantage of it. I mean, it could be exploited by the opposition if they were united, but they're not.
How do we get the European Union to stop funding anti-Israel NGOs?
Well, I don't know if you saw that the International Court of Justice threw out a case that was brought by one of the monitoring groups that monitors the incitement and the support being given by the European Union, which is estimated in the last, I think, from 2005 to 2010, I think, it's some range like that, more than $50 million to groups working inside Israel, many of them to engage in propagandistic and other activities against Israel, within Israel, and from the territories, et cetera, and they, throughout the case, would refuse to hear it on a number of grounds. The claim was that there's no transparency in the process, and people don't know, Europeans don't know where their money is going to fund these radical groups. They said that it was because of business concerns, because of security reasons and others, that the court refused to accept it. So the Europeans continue. I mean, they condemn Israel. They condemn the construction. They don't say a word about the threat from Mashal, who this week again said that the reconciliation, you know, recognized that all of Palestine belongs to the Palestinians, and Hamas taking the lead. The corruption that continues there, that they continue to give hundreds of millions of dollars, which goes into Abbas and his kids, into other people's pockets, according to the accusations, and the Palestinians themselves, they don't pay the taxes, they don't pay for their electricity, because they say that the money ends up in corruption and the pockets of the wrong people, or that the international community is obligated to support them. And the Europeans just go, you know, happily along their way supporting this and condemning Israel. There are very strong statements about the construction, the implications of threats of sanctions, and talking about monitoring, you know, any construction in Jerusalem. The British this week, very strong statements. The European Union passed resolutions of condemnations against Israeli construction. And yet, on the serious threats, they're not heard.
Yep.
And so I think the situation in Europe, where we see the continuing rise of anti-Semitism and incidents across the continent, is one that we warned about many years ago, and I know, again, people don't like to hear this stuff and think this is doom and gloom. This is reality, and the way you fight is by recognizing it and dealing with it. The problem was that too many times in Europe, European Jews and others did not want to face up to it, and now this cancer is growing.
Speaking of stuff we don't want to read about, enough is enough already with all these former officials in Israel, some of whom from the religious community, who are being cited for ethics violations from years ago. I mean, I'm being very vague in the way I'm presenting it, but
I don't know who you're talking about, because it's a long laundry list. But
when you read about former chief rabbis and the accusations, it's just terrible. But anyway,
and you saw the new charges against Lieberman, which are stronger, although no new charges are added. It's supposed to come out today or Sunday.
And there's an election in 3 weeks, but I know
But
I know that you won't go there every time I ask you about that.
Well, no, the important thing is that Lieberman was counting on the fact that the charges so far have been very mild, that the real charges of corruption, et cetera, were dropped.
Not serious
stuff.
So
now they've strengthened these charges based on what they said is new information, and the question is where it came from. And this has to do with corruption regarding the appointment of a certain ambassador to Belarus, and that ambassador tipped him off to some of the charges and investigations, whatever, against Lieberman. So that's what the current case revolves around. The question is, does it get resolved before the election or not? And could they prevent him from running? I'm sure somebody will think of a lawsuit to get him out of it as well.
My prediction, it'll be resolved right after the election. Moments.
That's a good bet.
Moments after.
I would say 50-50 that it gets resolved before or after.
Moments after the polls close. Malcolm, thank you. We will speak in 2013, please, God.
God willing, and everybody just be careful.
Oh, yeah. Have a one. Be careful.
Well, this is a time when there are a lot of road accidents and people.
Very good reminder. I see you're taking all responsibility under your belt.
I'm concerned about everybody all the time.
I like that. You're a real parent and grandparent. You've proven it now.
That's true.
Great concern. Have a wonderful Shabbos. Malcolm Homeline is Executive Vice Chairman of the Conference of Presidents, Major American Jewish Organizations. Fridays, we have the weekly update here at JM and the AM.